This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
The stage, Julia Wheeler and Sir Don McCullin.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this real treat of an event. I'm really absolutely delighted to welcome Sir Don this afternoon. We're going to be talking about his latest book, Landscape, and we've got some beautiful pictures to share with you, but also about your life, your early life, how you got your break, your time at the Sunday Times, and it's going to be all-encompassing. But I think we'll be led, of course, by the photographs. So let's begin with those. We're going to start here in Finsbury Park. Tell us about this photograph.
I took this photograph when I wasn't even really a photographer. And I took this photograph from my bedroom window where me and my brother used to sleep in this terrible old tenement house. And the buildings behind are stables where, when I was a boy, there were still a lot of horse-drawn vehicles delivering milk and bread and coal and beer. So there were lots of beautiful Shire horses which would come back at night to the stables behind my house. And I went to school in the far distance there, not for very long, because I played truant quite a lot. So I could say this was my first landscape photograph. And I did it on a 35mm camera. I'm not a great camera. I'm not interested in cameras very much. They do the job.
Now, that's strange for a photographer.
Yes, because I think my life in photography has been an emotional experience, not a camera bug experience. I think most of the photography, particularly dealing in human tragedy, I've had to use my emotions to show you the disadvantages of being in the wrong place at the wrong time in life. I'm talking about wars and revolutions and earthquakes and famines. I've done all of that.
So when you look at that photograph, what's the emotion that comes to you now?
Well, I think you poor devil living in such a terrible place, because I lived in my family and I, we grew up, we were quite impoverished, and myself, my brother, my mother and father slept in one room. So I've made this long journey in my life. And, you know, every Saturday I would go to the local bathhouse to have a bath. And it's a stigma that never really leaves you. And I've got a terrible compulsion now to be, you know, I'm mad about tidiness and baths and showers, and I'm obsessed with clean shirts and things like that, which I'm not wearing today, but I'm too cold. But I have my background has played a major important role in my present life, really.
And so how much did that feed into you becoming a photographer later?
Well, I became a photographer by accident. I went to do my national service in 1954. And I did 2 years in the RAF in a photographic unit. And I was sent to Egypt and Africa and Cyprus and Aden. And I left the RAF a failed photographer because I did not pass the photographic test, because I have a terrible problem reading. So I came out of the Air Force with a camera, but not with the distinction of having the qualifications of a photographer. So I was a failed photographer in the RAF sense, but I've tried to make up for it since, really.
Have you ever been back to the RAF and show them your portfolio?
No, I haven't, but they've invited me to go and speak at their somewhere in Birmingham where they are, and I've refused, actually. I don't bear grudges too much, but when you fail something, you think you can never get over it. And I think you can, because I've proved that, really.
So when did you get your first break? When was the first photograph that you actually got money for?
Well, in this district I grew up in, I grew up with a very bad bunch of boys, and none of us went to school. We played truant constantly, and we were troublesome, and we didn't like authority. And it basically, we grew up in a ghetto. I mean, one only assumes ghettos were associated with Warsaw in the war, and also black ghettos in America and places like that. But there was such a thing as ghettos for poor people in England, you know. People who had I mean, for instance, when I was a boy, I grew up wearing other people's clothes. My mother used to go to a second-hand shop, buy a shirt and beat the life out of it in the wash tub, and I would wear it for school. And I'd wear the same shirt to go to bed in at night because we didn't have anything. And looking back, it was the best possible way to grow up to face the work I did in future years as a photographer. So I grew up with these boys, and then one night I wasn't there, and they clashed with another gang, because in the 50s, London was a very tribal area. It was a no, you wouldn't go there and they wouldn't come here. And then one night, a gang of boys came from Islington to attack these boys I went to school with. And one of the men killed a policeman at the end of my street. And I photographed these boys a few months later, and I took the pictures to the Observer newspaper, and they said, did you take these pictures? And I said, yes. Will you do more? And I said, yes. They published the photographs, and they gave me £50, which was a king's ransom to a man, a boy like me in that, from that background. And that was my journey into photography. And the next morning, they published on a Sunday morning. On a Monday morning, the phone rang where I worked in this little darkroom in Mayfair, and I was offered every job in England. I mean, it was absolutely ridiculous. I was offered a job in television, newspapers and things, and I wasn't a photographer. But I kind of pirouetted, picked up a lot of photographic books and taught myself photography. And I'm still learning after 65 years.
So in that moment then, you came to be an observer, really. Rather than being part of that world, you came to be looking at it with a different eye.
Well, I had to understand, you know, what I was, the journey I was about to embark on. In basically, it was to do with journalism, but I'm not a journalist, I'm a photographer, not a writer. So I started traveling in England. And by the way, at the age of 15, when my father died, I was 13 when my father died, my first job was, I worked on a steam train, and I went from London to Manchester, and I was traveling through these satanic cities in England. I was going London to Liverpool, London to Manchester. I worked in the dining car washing up dishes. I'm great at washing up, by the way. What I was learning was, I broke out from Finsbury Park and I was traveling independently to these satanic cities in the north of England and seeing other cultures. And in those days, there were many dialects in England which have all been almost eradicated today, possibly through television and Hollywood films. That we started losing our culture, our dialects and things like that. So I know my country backwards. And the Observer used to send me to mining strikes and this strike and that strike. And so I'd been all over England before I was about 25. I'd been to every little town in this. And England's a fascinating place. And I have one favorite place at the moment. And I'm sure there are people here who've been there. And if you haven't, please go there. It's Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland. It's the most beautiful place, and I go there in the winter when it's snowing. Mm. And I was there 2 years ago, and it was completely empty, and there was a blizzard, and I was the only one there, and I put the camera to my eye, and suddenly a figure. I thought, oh, my God. And I was going, please. And then he did move out the way, and I got down for the wall, which you mustn't stand on, which I was. And I went to the man and I said, I'm terribly sorry to be rude to you. And but he had his back to me first. And when he turned round, he was from Asia. And I thought it was a kind of meeting of extraordinary men, that the man from Finsbury Park was meeting the man from Kazakhstan. It was a kind of blessing that made me feel that, you know, there are millions of people working in jobs they don't like in cities and in offices, and there am I, I've had this freedom for the last 60 years, and I can stand on Hadrian's Wall when it's empty, and I feel totally liberated, as if I can fly with my arms. I'm a very lucky man.
So here's a photograph of Hartlepool, which is in the landscape book, and what you started to do, the route you took, despite having all of these offers, was the sort of social context, wasn't it, to look at social deprivation and so on in England in the 60s?
Well, this was in 1963. It was one of our coldest winters, but I think maybe we've been overtaken in the last few days. But I got into my old Ford car and I drove 300 miles to this place. And I arrived there the evening before and I saw this strange scenery. So I got in the back of my car and slept because I couldn't afford a hotel. And I had a bottle of Tizer, which is an old-fashioned Coca-Cola, and I had a custard tart for my breakfast. And in the morning when I woke up, the Tizer was rock hard and my custard tart was like a piece of rock. And I thought, I saw this scene and I thought, I need a human being. But the scene to me said something else. It said, this would have been what you would have seen at Auschwitz in the Second World War. This looked like the scene of a concentration camp where people would have gone to the crematoria. I have a very mixed emotional thing when I put the camera to my eye. I see a different scene. I see a different story. And I know it sounds a bit crazy, but most of my photography is done through my emotion. And when I was 15 years of age, that's a few years after the war ended, 10 years after the war, I saw the first pictures of the Belsen camps and the Auschwitz tragedy. And at the age of 15, it made a very strong impression on me. I can still see those images in my mind. And this is what this picture represents for me.
So it's very politicised right from the beginning.
Well, I find the north of England has never had a fair deal, really. These were the people in the Industrial Revolution. I'm sorry if I sound like as if I'm preaching, but the people who live in the north of England have a wonderful, kind spirit. They feel betrayed by their history, that they were responsible for making England the great industrial nation we became. And they've always been forgotten. And I think that's why they probably paid recently, they voted probably for the Brexit situation that we're now in. So I've always felt sorry for the people who live in the north of England.
And we should say that there's a BBC 4 documentary coming out on Monday in which you've gone back, to all areas of England, actually, haven't you? How have you found that experience?
Well, what they've done, they've built hundreds of houses in Consett. This is a steel, you know, because we're looking at the beginning of the collapse of the steel industry in this country. And then I went back to find this location and found it impossible to find. It was impossible to find this place. And so the north of England is still the north of England. It's still quite tragically poor. And even the homes they're building for people, they don't represent what I think these people deserve. And they're a form of almost an opium to keep them down and keep them quiet. You know, I forgive my strange way of talking about this.
Let's come back down south. This is Southend-on-Sea, around the same sort of time.
Well, this was when I was a boy, we didn't have things like holidays in my family. We couldn't afford holidays. There was a railway station in a place called Crouch End in London. You got on the train and you wound up at Southend. I had one day a year holiday as a child with my mother. We'd all get into one of those small railway compartments. She would always find an excuse to argue with somebody in that train. And it made me feel incredibly embarrassed. And she would swear with it, which I also hate. So I enjoyed my day and didn't enjoy it because my mother was upset us some way. But Southend-on-Sea is only the Thames estuary, really. You have to be very careful about not treading on broken glass on that beach. You came out of the railway station and you smelt the sea air and you ran to that beach. And all you could smell in the background was terrible cooking and terrible fried up this or fried up that, you know. But as a child, it was everything in the world to me.
This is a different coast, and people might be surprised at where that is.
Well, it's the Amalfi Coast in Italy. I've tried to make it look like Cleethorpes in eastern England, but it's some old poor Italian man, you know, walking up that beach. It is not the Amalfi weather.
No, that's not a sky that you associate with Amalfi, is it?
Not at all. Well, I've got a thing about skies. I call these skies Wagnerian skies. I always think of Wagner, who's not very well loved in the world because of his association with Adolf Hitler. But anyway, when I'm in the darkroom, I print these skies very dark. I have a passion for printing my pictures very dark. They're hardly... Somebody said to me once when I did some pictures of the Somerset landscape that the Somerset Tourist Board won't thank you for these pictures. But you might see one of them later on if you don't.
So let's talk a little bit about that, the process then. You mentioned that you're not fussed so much about the kit as you are about the finished product. But how much are you able and how much do you enjoy manipulating things within your darkroom?
The word manipulation makes me seem like a fraud in a way.
No, I didn't mean that at all.
I go into my darkroom because where I live in Somerset, I go out and take pictures, particularly this time of year. I wait the whole year for snow, and here I am in London. And I shall drive back like fury after this and, you know, hopefully find some snow. I can do some landscapes. But I go into my darkroom. I don't do anything really naughty in the darkroom. I just print the sky a bit dark, you know. I don't think that's a treasonable act. But when I'm in the darkroom, I play classical music and I'm very... Once again, I'm alone in the darkroom. If I make a mistake and I tear up a sheet of paper, that's 25 quid. Because, you know, photographic paper is very expensive, the chemistry. And if I tear up a sheet of paper, nobody else can see it. So I can hide all my mistakes. And I'm ashamed of... At the end of the day, I can sometimes look in the bin and see 100 quid's worth of torn-up paper. And I'm not proud to say that. But I'm just giving you an idea that the darkroom is a strange place. You can embrace all your demons in the darkroom. All the things, I have many demons. I have many days in my life where I photograph terrible things like men being murdered in front of me, people being massacred in front of me in massacres in the Middle East wars. So, you know, I walk on very thin ice, and sometimes I think of these things at night when I'm trying to go to sleep. I'm not an insomniac, and I'm not schizophrenic in any way. I'm quite balanced, but... You know, you don't take the kind of... These landscapes have been my psychiatrist's chair. They cured my emotional thoughts from the terrible things I've seen. And I do the landscape because I can stand there in the landscape and be alone once again. By the way, this is the Somerset Levels near Glastonbury. I always think the Glastonbury area is part of the Arthurian myth. But I don't think mythology and the stories are, over the years, they get out of control, really. They get embellished too much and get carried away by it, really.
But you first went to Somerset as an evacuee, didn't you, during the war, and then were sort of drawn back there?
At the age of five, I was sent... I remember driving through the great columns at Paddington Station, which have long since been removed, and... I had a gas mask and we were sent to Somerset. And I had a sister and we were sent to Frome and we were selected, like they did at Auschwitz, actually. My sister went to the big house and I went to the farm labourer's house. And I used to sometimes go up to my sister's house and look through the window and she would be being served tea by ladies with a black and white uniform and they would shoo me away. They'd say, "Oh, Murray's having tea, you must... go away." They never invited me in to have a tea. And I felt really sad about it, really. So all those years later, my sister and I just went in different directions. But
interestingly, your brother went in another direction as well, didn't he?
We're a very strange family. My brother joined the Foreign Legion. And he walked through the gates in Marseille and signed up for 5 years. They changed his name. The Foreign Office sent me a letter saying the Belgian police authorities are trying to locate your brother. I looked at the letter and I thought, it's nothing to do with me. I put it on the fire, to be honest. And my brother went away out of my life for 30 years and joined the Foreign Legion. And one day in Africa, in Central Africa, I landed at this military base, French base, and I saw my brother after never seeing him for several years. And he said, "I've got a fantastic present for you." He said, "I've got you a hunting rifle." And I said, "I live in Hampstead." And he was very cross. that I wouldn't take it is that I won it in a poker game. I said, I can't take it. I said, I simply can't take it. He was so cross with me. Sadly, he died a couple of years ago because he was a big smoker, you know. But I thought what a strange family we were. We were born and then we disintegrated. But I had the experience of partly being in London during the bombing and the war. So in a way, many years later, I was ready for war. I was ready to go to war. And the Observer said, would you go to the civil war in Cyprus? And I wound up going to my first. But by then, by the way, I'd already independently went to the building of the Berlin Wall. I bought a ticket for £40 and I flew to Tempelhof Airport, which was Hitler's personal airport. And I arrived in Berlin with £30 in my pocket. And I was at the beginning of the building of the Berlin Wall in 1961. So there were voices in me saying, go here, go there, do this, do that. And I've been incredibly grateful. When you normally hear voices, you need to go and see somebody. But these were the right voices for a change.
And how receptive were those Sunday Times picture editors to your voices and saying, I need to go there? And how much were they directing where you ought to go?
Well, I have to say it, my dyslexia didn't stop me, but I've been a great reader of newspapers. I'm fully aware at this point what's going on in this world, all the bad things, all the negative things. I've been reading newspapers and news stories my whole 60 years of my life, and I always knew where trouble was coming. I would go into the Sunday Times and say, we should be in Vietnam, we should... They would say, go then, go, just go. And I would come back with the pictures several weeks later. I'd never ring them from wherever I was. And I would stand behind them when they did the layout. And they'd say, you know, don't you need to go and have lunch or a cup of coffee? I said, I'm going to stay here and watch this. I was there. I knew the story. And it was a privilege in a way. They put up with me. And looking back on my life at the Sunday Times, it was the happiest part of my life, really. You know, I went to these extraordinary journeys. And by the way, I didn't cover war. I went to every country in this world. I went to the Amazon, where people were naked and they did rain dances. I went to Irian Jaya on the other half of New Guinea, where men wear funny things and do funny things and practice cannibalism. And in the last 6 years of my life, I've seen the traveling of, you know, traveling this world. I've seen all the traveling and had all the traveling experiences you could have. I've been in prison, I've had accidents, I've been in hospitals, I've had malaria. I've done the full university kind of degree in travel. And I can tell you lots about it that could actually put you off, I think.
Which is not the point of the destination show at all. Have there been moments when you were in those war zones or indeed elsewhere where you thought, actually, this is it, I'm not going to come out of this one?
Actually, it wasn't the war zone. I had the unpleasant experience of being arrested in my hotel swimming pool one day in Uganda, and I was taken down to the local police station, and I'd actually had a ticket taking me to Rome that night. It just went later on that night. Suddenly I found myself in the police station. Idi Amin went completely mad. And I was in the police station. I thought, well, they're going to take me to the airport. And so when we drove out to the police station in the Land Rover with my suitcase as well, and they made me pay the bill in my hotel when they arrested me, and instead of turning right for the airport, they turned left to the military prison camp. And I got the biggest beating of my life. I arrived in the yard, and I could see all these African soldiers drinking beer. And I thought, that's a bad sign. And the second bad sign was when they reached for these great bamboo rods and came running to the truck. And I thought, this is not going to be nice. And I got a terrific beating and a whipping and kicking. And they took me to they called it the VIP wing of the prison. By the way, this can happen to any traveler. It's not just the old photographers like me. And I spent 4 days in the prison where they were killing people and taking the bodies away in the morning to chuck into the River Nile with the crocodiles. You know, this is not a dream story I'm telling you. It was real. I'd look out of those prison bars and say to myself, you're not going to get out of here alive. And strangely enough, the British High Commission finally got their act together and they got me out. And I flew back to England and the plane couldn't land at London Airport and it can only land at Manchester. So I said, oh, well, don't worry, we get breakfast on the train. And I went to the dining car and they said, breakfast full up, sorry. So, but I was grateful to be alive. And but on the battlefield, I could make decisions. I could say, you can wait or you can run. And one day in Cambodia, I came under fire and I lost my nerve because the people with me were getting baddish. And I lie down in the mud and I held my camera on the side of the rice field to keep it dry. And then I thought, okay, get up now and run and zigzag across the field. I was incredibly fast when I was a young man. I was zigzagging because I knew a sniper was trying to get me. And when I finally got about 600 yards away and I was out of, and I threw myself down and checked my equipment, and one of my cameras had taken a bullet and smashed the side of it and went up. And it didn't worry me because I was alive. And I thought, you know, you signed up for this life and you needn't have got on the aeroplane at London Airport to go there. And I thought that was my psychology throughout the whole of my life. If I didn't like what I saw when I got there, I should never have got on the plane at London Airport.
But the next time when you were thinking about getting on that plane at London Airport, did you, I mean, were there times where you thought, actually, I'll find something different to shoot. I'm not going to send myself back into that war zone situation. Or what was it that kept you going back?
Well, I have to tell you that when you came from my background and you had no education and you're a bit stupid and you came from stupid friends and background who had nothing but bigoted minds and, you know, only destructive thoughts about, you know, we didn't like authoritarian, we didn't like the police, we didn't like going in the army or the air force. I by then realized what a fortunate person I was. And also, I have to tell you, when you first go to war, I mustn't say the wrong thing here, but when you first go to war, it's incredibly exciting until you realize the price that has to be paid for it by other people, not particularly me. When you see the women and children, they're always the last to be told, you know, what's going to come to them, or when it eventually comes to them. Everybody I've photographed in my life, I don't think about the soldiers because they know it could happen to them, but I've seen countless thousands of women and children injured, burned, starved, beaten. I've seen the worst possible things humanity can get up to. And that changed my mind about photographing war. It was exciting when I was a young man because I was defiant. And then I had to wise up. And I walked into a camp in Biafra in 1968-69. I saw 600 dying children in front of me. And they were actually collapsing, dying in front of me. And I had children of my own in England who had endless food. And these children were looking at me. And they probably thought I was from an aid agency. And all I had to offer them was two Nikon cameras around my neck, you know. And I can never stop thinking about that day. There was an English nurse, an English doctor, cradling one standing dying child, holding another child, and another child was clinging onto her. None of those children would have survived. They were just dropping down, dying in front of me. And I took a picture of an albino boy, and albinos in Africa, even today, are very much persecuted. That people think there's something strange about them and they should be, you know, eradicated. And so this poor albino boy was looking at me, he was 9 years of age, and he's haunted me all those years. And he lives in my house now. He lives in my house as a negative, but he's in that house, and I think he... In a way, I have 60,000 negatives in my house, and I think that house in Somerset, as nice as it is contaminated. And I did a book once about that big, and it was called Sleeping with Ghosts. I got the title from what goes on in my house.
So it sounds as if there's been a sort of a guilt about being there and not being able to do more than photograph. But at the same time, that's balanced with, actually, I've got to bear witness to this and show the rest of the world what's going on.
Well, I was working for the Sunday Times, so I had a job to do. That doesn't excuse the fact that what I was doing... I mean, it almost sounds immoral, really, that you know, you have all these people dying of starvation in front of you, and you go there photographing. It's as if you're having a great day out. Well, I wasn't. The mere fact I'm talking about today is that I have the most enormous guilt trip on my back, on my head. And so I'm not trying to exonerate myself and try to get out of all this. I did it. I saw it. I didn't do it to them. I came away. No picture I ever took of those situations ever saved any lives. You know, there was a strange feeling that an investment of this work would perpetrate something to come, but it was never going to save those people, those poor people, really. So I walk a very strange tightrope. I walk on very thin ice, and, you know, I can be funny sometimes. I do laugh sometimes, but I don't laugh at other people's expense. No. I have my own rules, which I've been very strict about, and I won't break those rules.
Mm. One of your very iconic images is the one on the front here. The US Marine.
Yes.
In Vietnam, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And his eyes are just staring blankly. Can you talk a little bit about consent to take a picture like that, and indeed other pictures in which people are suffering, or mentally or physically?
The age of consent has never been in my case. You know, everything I've ever done in my life as a photographer, you could say I've stolen. I've been a thief. I've often seen men being executed. I do not have their consent to their murder. I mean, I've seen men crying in front of me, thinking I can intervene, and you cannot. You know, you cannot. I've seen men shooting women down in cold blood in front of me. I haven't photographed that, of course, but I saw some men dying once in Africa, and the commander said to another man, kill them. And I could see the men shaking, but they were blindfolded. Thank God I didn't see their eyes. You cannot intervene because, you know, if you did, they would pick on you. You know, you're an observer there, but you're not there's no given right to be the observer of murder, because executing a man is murder, really. I was in a massacre in Beirut one day where they murdered every Palestinian man and boy over the age of 14, and I was told to leave the area. And as I left the area, they were just shooting men in groups, and as I left the area, I could hear music, and it was a lute. And the man said, you leave here, you do not photograph any, we'll kill you. And I thought, well, they will, since they're doing it in front of me. So I walked away with a journalist from the Sunday Times, and I could hear this music. And I looked down the street, and I could see a group of boys. They could have only been 17 years of age. One of them had a lute, and he was standing over the body of a Palestinian girl lying in this winter rain. And I said to the journalist, I don't care, I've got to do this picture. I did it very quickly. I didn't take an exposure. The negative is very thin. But that picture is, you know, it turned out to be a picture that nobody can really fathom out. Mm-hmm. Why a person with such revenge would serenade the body of an innocent Palestinian girl lying in this winter rain in the middle of the road in Beirut. My good question you asked me about, I never had permission from anybody to be the witness of their murder. I never had the permission from starving children. You know, I sit almost in an electric chair. I feel guilty as hell about all the things I've done. And everything I've done hasn't changed a thing about changing the face of war. It hasn't done a thing.
It's made people more aware. But let's come back. Let's come back to Somerset. Because you've talked about being in Somerset and photographing the landscape there as a sort of healing for all that's gone before.
This is a, believe it or not, this is a lake. This is not a lake, it's a small pond. But animals, farm animals, are very curious. When they see man or woman, they think, oh, food delivery. They'll always come towards you. And that's what's happening in this case. And what I did, I knew they were coming. I timed it so that the cow in the middle splashed the water. the projection won't be that good for you to see this detail. But I always love photographing by the end of the day. I never photograph in the morning time because the sun comes up very quickly. I'm always looking at the sky. Constable painted the most wonderful skies in England, him and Mr. W.M. Turner. But I always look at the sky when I wake up in the morning and pull the curtains in my house. I think, is it a landscape day? And sometimes I stand in the fields for hours and hours. And one day I stood in a field near where I live, and I saw this man coming with a Jack Russell. He was coming all around the edge of the field, and I was standing here. He passed me, never said a word. He went all the way. He came all the way back again and passed me, never said a word. And I thought, this is the most curious thing. You know, he never spoke to me because he was trying to be polite. I thought he could have at least said good morning, but not a word. And I loved him for that act of respect, and because he thought I was probably an artist, which I'm not, by the way. I hate the word artist. I'm a photographer. And one day I was standing in Devon. I was sent by the Daily Telegraph to illustrate the legend of King Arthur. Once again, you know, a legend that's been much embellished. And I was standing there, and I could hear splashing through this dike-y river dike. And it was an otter, and it was coming down, and it had an eel in its mouth, and it looked at me like that, and then belted off. And I've been in places where foxes appear, and I think such rich rewards for my silence and for my, you know, I can sometimes spend hours doing landscape. I get no landscape picture, and I assimilate myself as a man who would sit by a lake and fish all day long and catch no fish. It's being there. Just being in the English countryside rewards you. You will always be rewarded if you have the patience to seek reward. Even if you don't get reward, you've still had a great day out, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's get the microphones out, if we may, perhaps one either side, and stick your hand up if you've got a question for Don. It can be about photography, it can be about travel. Who's got the first question? Don't be shy.
Nobody.
There's a question. We go there, and then we'll come to you in a second if we could get a mic there.
Okay. Hi, Don. You've covered wars and conflicts everywhere. Would you say that it was addictive at some time?
Yes, a very good question, actually. Yes, it was, I'm afraid. In the old days, when I first started going to my first war, the Civil War in Cyprus, there maybe were 36 correspondents there. And when I got to the Gulf War, the First and the Second Gulf War, there were 2,000 correspondents there. And there's no question about it. We were, at some stage of our lives, war junkies. We were addicted to it. And, you know, as I said in the beginning of our conversation the other day, when you first went, you went under the kind of premise of films you'd seen in Hollywood, who, by the way, have played a major role in spoiling our world, really. The violence that's coming out of Hollywood now is absurd, really. But when I first went to war, I noticed people were bleeding. In the Hollywood films, you saw people being struck with bullets and things. And cowboy films, there was never any sign of blood, you know. When you went to war and you saw the price of war in human flesh and blood, it was quite horrendous. And in the end, you come off your addiction. But one day, my first visit to Vietnam, there was an execution in the early morning in the Chinese section of Saigon. It was called Cholon. And someone said, you've got to get down there. There's an execution this morning. So I went down there. It was my first visit to Vietnam, 1964. And it was dawn in the morning. And they dragged some poor soul out of a Volkswagen camper, tied him to the stake, and shot him. And I heard one of the journalists who was standing on a kind of truck full of journalists. I was standing down. I didn't take any pictures, by the way. And I heard one of the journalists shout, great stuff, did you get it? And I think in a way there was the first few words in war that I heard that it was revolting to hear someone acclaiming this public murder. And I think in a way it was my baptism of brutal execution, but it served me well that morning, because when I heard somebody calling it great stuff, I knew it was a criminal voice. And it was because he himself was part of that addiction. And, you know, and he became a very famous man later on in America. I know his name, I'd never divulge it, but he became a very great reporter in America. And, you know, I think the trouble is with not just reporters, people, photographers, painters, we are all flawed in some way or other. None of us are perfect. So in the beginnings of our occupations, our lives, we have to learn. We have to learn to choose another direction.
Thank you. There was a question just here. You got the mic? The other mic? Yep, go ahead.
Perhaps with the exception of the Biafran albino, which of your photojournalistic shots do you consider the most memorable?
Everybody tries to talk about this photograph, which I'm sick and tired of this photograph. The only thing about this photograph, I think this man almost has the eyes of Jesus Christ. Now, I'm not a religious person, based on the fact of 60 years of seeing, which I hope Jesus Christ would have been appalled at. But a friend of mine took a photograph in Saigon of a police chief shooting a man in the head. He took that photograph 7 years before the war in Vietnam ended. No photograph ends a war. The public opinion in America changed when they saw that photograph. They thought, why are we supporting a country that has a criminal chief of police shooting people ad lib in the streets? So, and my friend, the photographer, said, I hate that photograph. He said, because it eradicates all the other wonderful pictures I've taken before the day I took that photograph. So I hate this photograph because people keep using it as an iconic. It's not an icon. It was a picture of a man who was shell-shocked. We've tried to get in touch with this man. He's alive in America, but he's still suffering slightly, you know, his intense memory of the war, and he wouldn't collaborate with us meeting up with him. But I have been in touch with a lot of the men who I photographed in this book, and I photographed a young man, a black soldier, throwing a grenade. And he looks like one of Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of Will, which was done in 1936, I think, in the Olympic Stadium. He's now an old man in Chicago in a wheelchair. You know, I've had the chance in 60 years to witness youth and then, you know, gravitating towards kind of heart seizure failures. And being in wheelchairs, I've seen young men and I've now seen old men like me. I've had a life that's been a strange experience, really. And I'm now trapped with all these memories in my head, and sometimes they come out and play a merry dance when I try to sleep at night. I am not an insomniac, thank God, but it's very hard to get to sleep sometimes. Even when I'm incredibly worn out and tired, I'm sure some of you felt like that when you've got off an aeroplane. You're so tired, so frazzled, you can't sleep. And if you start debating and wrestling with the idea of sleep, it gets worse.
We began with that, your first landscape, looking out across Finsbury Park, and we're going to end with a landscape in Somerset. Had you not grown up in that area when you were younger, do you think you would have had the same life, the same success, the same drive and perseverance?
No, I think I was struggling against becoming like the boys I grew up, many of whom went to prison, armed robbery, even murder. I probably shouldn't say these things, but I'm not trying to gain any points here, but I would never really wanted to be incarcerated as a criminal. It wasn't in me to be a criminal. I didn't want to be a criminal. I didn't want to follow this. I didn't like their conversation. I was bored to death being with them. All they talked about was violence, stealing, robbery, and it wasn't me. I was a different creature. And luckily, photography chose me. I didn't choose it. And photography gave me a magic carpet ride. And we've not talked at all about travel here today. I've traveled to every corner of this earth long before the T-shirt was invented. And so I went to countries where people still... When I first went to India in 1965 with a very famous travel writer called Eric Newby, if you went to Delhi, you would have thought there was a snowstorm going on, because everywhere people were wearing the dhoti, the white costume, it was their national costume. And now you go to India now, they're all wearing slightly shabby kind of Western clothes. Luckily, the women in their saris are clinging to the Indian culture. But I've seen so many cultures in the world ruined because, I mean, why shouldn't people wear clothes? I mean, why shouldn't people, Aboriginal people, you know, be dressed and have what we've got? We don't want to keep them like trophies in a kind of zoo, you know. They must have what we've got. So I think my travelling life is coming to an end now. When I went to London Airport as a young man, I had an excitement inside my stomach. You couldn't imagine how excited I was. And when I go to London Airport now, I feel depressed. And the other day the man said, take your shoes off, take your belt off. And I felt like saying, you shouldn't talk to me like that. But if I did, you see...
You wouldn't get on the plane.
I would not be going abroad.
No.
And then one last story, if you don't mind. I was in Israel because I covered the war in Israel, many wars in Israel. And I was with a correspondent with me who got killed, and I was told to come back, my editor, Harold Evans. And I got to the airport, and I was lining up with my boarding pass, and an Israeli man opened the door, came out straight to me. He said, please come with me. And I said, what's the problem? He said, no problem. Come into this room. And I said, what is the problem? He said, no problem. Take all your clothes off. I said, there is a problem. I'm not going to do it. And he said, well, you're going to miss the flight. And I said, what's this all about? He said, take your clothes off or miss the flight. I said, so I didn't. And I was looking at my watch and thought, he's right, I'm going to miss the flight. So I stripped off and he said, bend over. And so I got dressed and I said, you know what, the problem, your problem is you're sick. And he said, get out of here. And I've never forgotten that, and I've never been back to Israel, sadly. You know, I don't judge people, nations, by their politics. I judge their leaders, but not their people. You know, everyone has a right to have a life in this world, and I've seen so many people who haven't even reached that stage. And I will never see peace in my lifetime, never. And I'm sorry if I come across to you as an old cynic and pessimist and slightly dreary and boring.
Certainly,
but I'm not like that at all.
It's been a wonderfully thought-provoking 45 minutes, and we thank you for it, as we do for all of the images within these wonderful books and the pictures that you've painted on the stage today. So Dom will be over signing books. Do go, please, and have a flick through. We haven't even scratched the surface, even of one book, let alone all the others that are over there, including your autobiography. So Don has a retrospective that's starting off at Tate Britain next week, and as I say, also on BBC 4 Monday night, 9 o'clock. Do tune in for that. Thank you so much for being here, Sir Don Cullen.